Hello and welcome to Mito Action's roundtable discussion with Dr. Melanie Gillingham, where tonight we'll be discussing LCHAD retinopathy update moving toward a treatment. My name is Stephanie Harry, and I'm an LCHAD parent and one of the patient support coordinators at Mito Action, and I'll be your host for this evening. Today's discussion will be recorded and available on Mito Action's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This space is a little different than our traditional expert series. We set this call up as a Zoom meeting, which means that you have both video and audio access. So please take this time and make sure that you're muted and that your video is either on or off, depending on your preference. It's very important that you keep your audio off while you're not speaking. This will give everyone a more pleasurable experience. If you have any questions during Melanie's presentation, please feel free to put them in the chat and I can ask them after the presentation. Or if you'd prefer, you can ask your own question after the presentation. Just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you. Please remember to keep your questions more general and not specific about your specific situation. So without further ado, let me officially introduce Dr. Melanie Gillingham. Dr. Melanie Gillingham's research in the Department of Molecular and Medical Genetics has focused on various novel therapies for fatty acid oxidation disorders. For 20 years, Dr. Gillingham and her colleagues have conducted clinical trials in subjects with disorders in the fatty acid oxidation pathway. She has examined the effects of MCT supplementation prior to exercise and the effects of increased dietary protein on metabolic control and energy balance in subjects with LCHAD, CPT2, and VLCAD deficiencies. Dr. Gillingham serves on the Planning Committee for INFORM, an international group working for the advancement of medical and nutrition therapies for fatty acid oxidation disorders. Dr. Gillingham has also collaborated with Dr. Vockley to complete a randomized trial examining the effects of triamcinolone on myopathy and cardiac function of patients with long-chain fatty acid oxidation disorders. Dr. Gillingham has also conducted a series of studies examining the etiology of retinopathy in LCHAD and the role of diet in the progression of vision loss. Overall, her lab studies fatty acid oxidation disorders with a particular focus on LCHAD, and currently they have both human and basic science projects ongoing. Dr. Gillingham, we all appreciate you very much and all of your amazing work and your willingness to keep us updated as to what's going on and what's going on with your work. And it's a lot, but we really, really appreciate you and appreciate you taking this time tonight.
Thanks, Stephanie. That was a very, very nice introduction. I'm happy to be here. I am going to go ahead and share my slides. Okay, can you see those? Those slides are good. All right, awesome. Okay, welcome everybody. It's fun to see some familiar faces on the call. I'm going to give you an update, sort of where our progress is. A bunch of this data I recently presented at the SSIEM meeting and the INFORM meeting in Israel. Glad not to be in Israel today, but we were there in August. So let's just start off a little bit. I know you guys are familiar with this pathway, but here is the diagram of fatty acid oxidation. And I want to point out some definitions before we get into the clinical trial results from our cohort for natural history. So LCHAD is part of trifunctional protein. Trifunctional protein has an alpha subunit and a beta subunit. And two alphas find two betas, and they combine to make this protein that does three different enzymatic actions in the mitochondria. So for the first two, the enol-CoA hydratase, the hydratase action, puts this hydroxyl group on the third carbon on this fatty acid. And that's in the alpha subunit. The second activity of TFP is LCHAD. That's what we're all very familiar with. And that takes this hydrogen off and makes this double bond with an oxygen here. So that's what the LCHAD does. And then the third activity of trifunctional is a thiolase, where it cuts the molecule into two parts. So we have an acetyl-CoA, a small bit of the fatty acid, and then a little bit shorter fatty acid. And this one goes back up to the top and starts again. The reason I think this is important to understand is when we talk about LCHAD, we're talking about the loss of this second enzyme. And people who have a common variant in this gene, so a specific genetic change in this LCHAD region. It's known as G1528C, written here. And many people in the United States, but a lot of people in Europe have two copies of this. So remember, we can inherit one gene from our mom and one gene from our dad. And if you have two of the same copy, that would be here, you would have two copies of this common mutation. And some people inherit one copy from a mom and a different copy from a dad, or vice versa, and they would have one copy of this and then one private mutation in their family. And then there's other people on the call who may have trifunctional protein deficiency, and that's where you lose all three enzymes. None of the enzymes are working, but that's not associated with this particular mutation. So why am I spending so much time talking about this particular variant? Because when you have this variant, it decreases LCHAD, but the hydratase is intact. The hydratase works. And so because of that, that's why we get these hydroxy acylcarnitines and hydroxy fatty acids, because this is still there. And those hydroxy acylcarnitines and fatty acids come out into the bloodstream. And that's how we pick it up by newborn screening. And that's how we diagnose LCHAD. So it's an important thing. We're going to come back to these hydroxy acylcarnitines several times throughout the talk. So we've been doing a natural history study. Many of you are aware, and probably some of you participate. We've recruited 40 patients with either LCHAD or trifunctional protein deficiency, anywhere from the age of, well, it's up to 2 to 60, but our current cohort is 2 to 36. And participants come to either Oregon or to Pittsburgh, and they have a couple of long days of ophthalmology testing. They're staring at screens, getting pictures of their eyes, doing electroretinograms. So I'm going to show you some of the data that we've collected, looking at the retinal images, the visual acuity, the retinal function, and the visual fields of this group of participants. So let's start by talking about who is involved. So we tried to make sure that we covered the whole gamut of age range. So we started as low as 2 years of age up to as high an age as we could find. So we have 2 to 7-year-olds. There's about 8 participants who are between those ages, 6 males, 2 females. We have about 10 participants who are between the ages of 8 and 14. So sort of that school age, second grade, in there, second grade to maybe fifth, sixth grade, 10 of those. We have 13 that are like teenage, young adults, so 15 to 21 years of age, and then 9 who are greater than 21, I'd call adult, 21 years of age. And we have about an equal mix of males and females. One thing you will notice is that most everybody has that common mutation that we talked about just a minute ago. There's only 3 people that do not have that common mutation. So most everybody has either 1 or 2 copies of that common G1528C mutation. So the first thing I'm going to show you is data where we looked at what's the consequence or what's the effect of diagnosis by newborn screening or a family history compared to participants who had some sort of event and showed up in the emergency room with symptoms of LCHAD. So these were individuals that were probably born before their state was screening or potentially missed in screening and had some sort of event that sent them to the hospital and then subsequently were tested and diagnosed. So is there a difference between these two groups of participants in their vision? So in the family history group is bigger, the newborn screening is about 28, and then those that were diagnosed symptomatically, about 12. So a little bit lopsided as far as numbers, but it does allow us to kind of look at the differences. So looking a little bit more about these different groups, so the participants that were diagnosed by newborn screening, not surprisingly, are younger because they were born after most of the states in the United States began the screening, but they ranged in age all the way up to 36. And so the 36-year-old had a sibling that had LCHAD, and that's why this individual was picked up. But on average, the age in the symptomatic group was about 21. As far as rhabdomyolysis, these participants are older, so more of them have had rhabdo. Cardiomyopathy, I think these are pretty similar, not really that much difference. A lot of hypoglycemia. Neuropathy, these, again, participants are a little bit older, so there's a little bit more neuropathy. More chorioretinopathy. The premature birth and HELLP syndromes looks pretty similar across these two groups. Interestingly, everybody was put on a low-fat diet, so everybody was recommended to avoid fasting, follow a low-fat diet. Most people were on either MCT or C7, and I'd say about half on carnitine. So let's look at what the image looks like. So let's say you go to the ophthalmologist and he takes that little scope and he looks at the back of your eye. This is what you would see is a fundal image. And at first I want to just start with this A up here. So this is a participant who's 17 years age, and this whole top line are participants who were diagnosed by newborn screening or a family history, so an older sibling. And these images down here are patients who presented symptomatically, so had a crisis as an infant and went to the emergency room. I tried to match them up by genotype and by age. They're pretty close, not exactly across here. But let's start with this top one here. So you can see how this image is nice and smoothly pink. You can see the pretty blood vessels running through the eye. This is the optic nerve, so it's got a little bit of a white sheen right here. But this is a very normal looking, this is a completely normal looking retina. As you move older, you can see a little bit of spotting here where you're starting to see it's not as smooth, maybe a little bit of spotting here. And by here, you can see some areas of white where some of the cells are gone or are missing in these white areas here. And some of the pigment is clumping out towards the side. So I think the first thing you can see in this slide pretty quickly is that everybody is seeing some changes in older individuals. So regardless of whether they were diagnosed by newborn screening or symptomatically. But I think it's also really clear to see that symptomatically these retinas have more loss of pigment, more white spots, maybe more loss of these vessels that we see in the eye. So there seems to be a very big difference in the fundal images between participants of about the same age if they were diagnosed by newborn screening versus presented symptomatically. So these are kind of funny little x-rays of your eye. They're called autofluorescence. I think they're kind of hard to interpret, but the ophthalmologists that I work with just love these images. They get really excited about them. So I'll try to walk you through a little bit what this shows. So again, we're going to start up here at the top. This top row is the same participants who were diagnosed by family history. And these ones down here presented symptomatically. And you can see in this top, this is what you want to see. It's a nice, white, shiny image. And what happens is when they shine this light, the back of the retina has these dark cells and it reflects the light back. So you should see this nice white reflection of light back towards the camera. When you start seeing these dark spots, that's areas where the retina in the back has lost some cells. And so the light goes through and you get these dark areas. And this is sort of indicates that the retinal pigment epithelium, the cell layer in the back of the eye, is slowly degenerating. So you can see with time as patients are older, we see a little bit more modeling up here. But again, you can see pretty quickly that patients who presented symptomatically have more modeling, more black areas in the retina and as they get older. So both presentation, whether you were diagnosed by newborn screening or symptomatically, as well as age, seems to be playing a factor with a loss of the RPE in the back of the eye. So that's all great, but how does that translate to what I see, right? How does that translate to what vision I have when I'm, doing my normal activities of daily living? So this is an actual graph of the vision of the of our participants. So we have age up here on the x-axis. So again, from 2 to about 36 is our oldest participant. And then we have this funny measure of how good your vision is called LogMAR. Again, the ophthalmologists love this, but I tried to kind of give you an example. So a 0 LogMAR is equivalent to a 20/20 vision. If you went to the optometrist and they said, oh, you've got really good eyes, this is 20/20 vision. And a 2 LogMAR is like 20/632. So that's very bad vision. So the more you go up, the worse the vision, the visual acuity in this graph. Now I've put both right eye and left eye. So the circles are your right eye and the squares are left eye. And blue are patients, participants who were diagnosed by newborn screening or a family history. And orange are participants who presented symptomatically as an infant and were diagnosed by subsequent testing. I've indicated the couple of patients who have trifunctional protein because their vision remains pretty good. And you can see that they're sort of up here, good vision, even out at 32-ish years of age. But what I hope you can also appreciate is that it's not exact. There's some variability here, but participants who were diagnosed symptomatically have lower vision over time. And it's lower than the participants who presented or were diagnosed by newborn screening. So what about that electroretinogram? So I know it's not a terribly wonderful test to do, but they put a little contact lens on your eye and they flash this light. So I'm going to talk you through some of these results. The rods here, this is the cells in the back of your eye that are responsible for our black and white vision. And so this is the test that's done in the dark. So you have to sit in this really, really dark room while your eyes get used to the dark, and then they flash this light. The normal range, what you would normally expect, is this gray shaded area here. So again, the trifunctional protein are in green and have relatively good rod amplitudes. The higher the flash, the better the rods are responding to this flash of light. The blue are participants who were diagnosed by newborn screening, and the orange by presenting symptomatically. And again, you can see that it's lower in older individuals and potentially a little bit lower in the symptomatic versus the newborn screening group. The cones are over here, and the cones are the cells in the back of the eye that are responsible for color vision, how we see red and green and blue. And so I'm showing you the same thing. And that's when we turn the lights on and let your eyes get used to the light and then flash the light for the electroretinogram. Again, the normal range is in this gray shaded area, and you can see the TFP participants have pretty good cone response. And it seems to be a little bit higher, although it is lower in older individuals, but it's higher in the participants who were diagnosed by newborn screening compared to symptomatic presentation. So this is another test. This is a test which all of us have experienced when we go to the optometrist. I'm sure they've had you like look and stare at a screen, and they'll give you a little remote and say, if you see the little flash in front of your eye, you click the button. And so the little thing will flash, and you click the button. And that tells the machine that you can see in that spot, wherever that flash was. So that's called a visual field. So it's basically measuring where in your vision you can see and where you can't. So again, let's start up here on A. When you see all this yellow, this is, you can see everything. That's you're be able to see all those points. This red right here in the corner, that's the nose. So this is the nose right here, and you're looking, staring at the ophthalmologist here. And you can see this again, top row, that is participants who were picked up by newborn screening or family history. You see pretty good vision. And then maybe in the older individual, you're starting to see little holes. So the ophthalmologists that I work with describe LCHAT as poking like little holes in the retina, and you can start seeing this here. But you can also appreciate that the participants who presented symptomatically, they have a little bit more holes at a younger age, and then the older ones really have a lot of places where they can't see. So this purple red color is they can't see in those areas. They couldn't see that little flashing light to push the button. So newborn screening and was associated with better visual fields, better vision across the whole eye. Another thing we did was contrast sensitivity. I didn't know anything about this test, but I'm learning. So contrast sensitivity is the ability to test, to see between gray and white, and to differentiate shades of things that you're looking at. So the normal range, again, is in this gray box. Participants that had trifunctional protein are here in green. And then participants who were diagnosed by newborn screening in blue, and those that presented symptomatically in orange. And again, you can see that it's lower at older ages, and seems to be a little bit lower in participants who presented symptomatically, suggesting a little bit more inability to distinguish between gray and white. So this is a picture of where we're zooming in just into the very, very center of the eye. And LCHAT is, we've always known it kind of starts in the center of the eye. And this is a picture of really what that might look like. So again, this is one of those tests where you're staring at this screen, and they're testing if you can see something right there in the middle of your eye. The yellow green color is, yes, you can see that. Here's the optic nerve. And you can see in the group of the that were diagnosed by family history, there's pretty good central vision until this patient who's older, about 28, 32, something there. They're not seeing anything in the center of the eye. However, the patients that were diagnosed symptomatically, it's much earlier where we're seeing this central vision loss. So I've shown you a ton of pictures and a lot of tests. So what do we know from all of this data? So what we've found is that early diagnosis with newborn screening and treating is associated with better fundal images and better structure of the retina, improved visual acuity, so the ability to see like a Snellen chart, improved cone function, in particular those cells that are responsible for our color vision, the ability to differentiate between gray and white, so contrast sensitivity, and a better visual field across the whole eye. You can see more area of your eye. So let's just talk a little bit about the difference here. So the participants who presented symptomatically, what symptoms did they present with? So they presented somewhere between 7 days of life, so really, really early in infancy, up to 3 years, but most of them presented at 4 to 6 months of age. And those of you who've had a child know that this is kind of the time when you start seeing symptoms of LCHAD. Many of them had some pretty catastrophic events occur during that really early time. So 8 of them had pretty severe hypoglycemia. 3 had cardiomyopathy, 2 had a cardiac arrest and were resuscitated. There was some liver dysfunction, failure to thrive, lethargy, feeding difficulties. Those are the symptoms that they presented with, things that we're very familiar with. And these events probably impacted very early on their vision. For the patients that were diagnosed by newborn screening, we had 8 that had a sibling. So they had either an older or younger sibling that were diagnosed with LCHAD, and so therefore they were screened. And 20 were picked up by a classic newborn screening heel stick. Now, at the time, 2 of them were diagnosed at 3 years of age. So they probably have a little bit milder LCHAD, but they were asymptomatic at the time. The remainder, however, were all picked up really early in life in the newborn period. Interesting, a lot of people have asked me, did anybody have symptoms prior to getting the newborn screening back? And it's 7 of them did have signs of hypoglycemia. So I think we can't say that these all these patients are milder. I don't think that's true. I think, you know, if they weren't picked up by newborn screening, they would have presented with these catastrophic events like we saw with the before we started screening. And there were several babies that had feeding difficulties and temperature instability before they got the result back. And then they knew it was LCHAT and were able to start treating. Now, after the diagnosis was made, the treatment recommendations were pretty similar between the two groups. So everybody's been recommended to avoid fasting, eat small, frequent meals, follow a low-fat diet, take MCT. Some people have switched to C7, but the treatment hasn't really been very different after the diagnosis has been made. So really what we're talking about is initiating treatment early in that first 6 months of life has really been the biggest difference between these two groups of participants. So what do we do with all this data? So I think my conclusions from this analysis is that diagnosis early and treatment early is associated with improved visual function and structure later in life. But however, even though that's true, it does seem to be declining with age. Age is also a factor, which suggests we do need some new treatments. Now, everybody on the call has someone who is diagnosed with LCHAT or is a family member or they themselves are a patient. So this information doesn't change whether you presented symptomatically or you were diagnosed by newborn screening. So what do you do with this data? I hope that, like me, you will continue to be a strong advocate for good newborn screening. This supports the fact that we need newborn screening for fatty acid oxidation and for LCHAT in particular in all states, good screening programs, good cutoffs so that we pick babies up early and get them into treatment quickly. I also hope to advocate that other countries around the world also include screening. So I think that's what we do with this information. We need to be advocates for newborn screening. The other thing observation that it is associated with age inspires me is that we need to find some other treatment approaches. We need to find something that's going to stop the progression over time and maintain vision for participants as they get older. So that's what I take from this data, is that we need to be newborn screening advocates and we need to continue to look for new treatments. All right, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I'm going to go back to talking about that genotype. So I know that those are sometimes confusing terms, but let's go just review what we talked about in the very beginning. So in our group of 40 participants, we had three who had trifunctional protein deficiency, so they don't have that common mutation. We had 23 who had one copy of that common variant, the G1528C, and then one private mutation that was unique to their family. And then we had 14 who had two copies. So both alleles were the common variant, the G1528C. So another question we asked is, what is the impact of genotype? What with your genetics, does that impact visual outcomes? So just again to emphasize that common mutation is here in this LCHAD enzyme activity. And the result of that is that you get these hydroxy fatty acids that come out and form hydroxyacyl carnitines that then go out into your blood, and they're higher in people who have that common pathogenic variant. In trifunctional protein deficiency, however, you've lost all three. You don't have the hydratase, the LCHAT activity, or the thiolase. And so really the blood, you see a little bit of hydroxies, but most of the acyl carnitines look a little bit more like VLCAD, more 14-1, 14-2 elevations and less hydroxyacyl carnitines. So let's look at genotype and how that might affect retinal function. So I'm going back to that electroretinogram where you have a contact lens on your eye. And let's start with over here, the rod. So again, this is in the dark and we're looking at black and white vision. So you sit in the dark and get your eye used to the dark. And then there's a flash of light that we show to your eye. The green here is the patients that have trifunctional protein deficiency. There's only three of them. So you can see there response to that flash of light is higher. It's up here. The purple is one copy of G1528C, and the orange is two copies of the common mutation. And they're kind of mixed together here, but you can see that it's a little bit lower if you have that common variant, whether it's one or two copies, and that it's decreasing or it's lower in participants who are a little bit older, so over time. So it seems like that variant, that G1528C, is associated with lower ROD function compared to not having that genetic mutation. Again, if we go over here to cones, that's you let the turn the light on, you let your eye adapt, and then we flash the light and we see something similar. So the green is the trifunctional protein patients, and their vision is pretty steady over time and pretty close to up here to the normal range. And then the purple and the orange, again, are one or two copies of that common variant. And they're mixed together, but a little bit lower in older participants and declining over declining in older people. So genotype seems to be very tightly associated with retinal function, the function of the rods and cones in the eye. So this is that same contrast sensitivity test where we're trying to look at whether you can see shades of gray and white. And again, the normal is in this gray range here, and you can see that the green, the TFP is up here in the normal range. The purple and the orange are mixed together, but it seems to be lower in older people. So both genotype and age seems to be associated with a decrease in the ability to distinguish gray and white. So looking at just overall all of these pictures, our statistical analysis shows that this common mutation, this G1528C, is associated with decreased vision and decreased retinal function. And that's it's also true that age is a factor. So again, everyone on this call, you can't do anything about your genotype. Your genotype is what it is. So what do we do with this data? I do think it's important to know your genotype. So have a conversation with your geneticist so you know what your genotype is. It gives you some information about what to expect, what might happen. And it's helpful just to understand what your genotype might be as it might influence your vision. So I think that's how we interpret or use this information going forward. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about some funny words, metabolomics, lipidomics. This is really about what's in your bloodstream. So it's a relatively new technique in science to say, let's look at all the metabolites. So you know in your blood you've got tons of different things floating around, lots of different proteins and lipids and all kinds of metabolites. And so one of the ideas is if we look at all those metabolites, maybe we could find the thing that's related, correlated, associated with vision that might that we might be able to tie to the visual acuity or the fundal images. And so we did something like that with the blood samples. So our participants in this study got one fasting blood sample. So we had, of our 40, we had 39 blood samples. And then we just got some normal healthy blood samples from a biobank. And we had 38 of those. And we sent these blood samples to the lab that were treated. And then they measured basically 700 plus different metabolites, over 700 different lipids, and then different things associated with fatty acids. And the question we wanted to ask is, what's different between someone who has LCHAT or trifunctional protein deficiency compared to someone who does not? Is there differences in the metabolites, the things that are in blood? And then you do these statistical analysis. I'm going to show you some interesting graphs called volcano plots. I've become interested in volcano plots here. And we're trying to look at these differences and see if there's anything we can tell in this blood sample that might help us know how to treat or slow down changes in vision. So that's really the purpose of it. Is there a difference in these metabolites? And is there some sort of clue we could use to treat LCHAD retinopathy. So let's start with the metabolome. So metabolomics measured about 700 different blood compounds. And our statistician looked to say what is higher and what is lower in participants who have LCHAD or TFP. So in this volcano plot, this is all the 700 different participants. And if we're at zero right here in the middle, then there's no difference. They're exactly the same between the control and the participant with LCHAD. They're exactly the same. And the further away you get, the more difference there is. So everything that's on this side is higher in someone with LCHAD, and everything that's on this side is lower in someone with LCHAD. And the ones that are really far away are really, really different. So something way out here is really different than the control. And we were trying to see if we could tell if there's something that's really different than the control that we might be able to associate with vision. So I've highlighted a few of them here. It's not going to be a surprise, right? So in the orange, the things that are really, really high are the 3-hydroxy fatty acids and carnitines. So here's 3-hydroxy allele, that's olive oil, basically the fat in olive oil hooked to carnitine. Here's 3-hydroxystearate. That's the fat that you find in butter. Mesterate, that's also in butter. And oleate, again, that's the one you see in olive oil. So these are 3-hydroxy fatty acids and acyl carnitines that are way high. Well, we know that because that's the block. That's the LCHAD block. So we know that these typically run high compared to someone who doesn't have LCHAD. That's how we diagnose it in newborn screening. So what was low? The things that are low I've listed here are not necessarily all that important, but I've seen this a couple of different times. The things that are low are what we call complex lipids. So they're fats that are not just your simple triglyceride, but a little bit more unique or complex. So sphingolipids, other things like that are low, and the 3-hydroxy fatty acids are high. When you look at it all, 700 compounds together, there were 91 things that were higher in participants with LCHAD and 269 that were lower. I don't know that it's super important to know each of these different categories, but these complex lipids were lower. It was really interesting. The energy doesn't show up because there's only 6 of them, but all of the TCA cycle intermediates, so the things that make ATP in your mitochondria were all lower in participants with LCHAD or TFP. And this is the thing that the C7 supposedly increase, or the hypothesis they increase this energy here. So it wasn't too surprising. We expected the hydroxy, acyl carnitines and fatty acids to be higher, and that's what we saw. There were a few interesting things like the low energy I thought was interesting, and then these low complex lipids. So that's what we learned from this particular analysis. We looked at the lipidomics. So again, this is the same type of plot, a volcano plot. So if it's zero, this measured like 900 different lipids. If it's zero, they're exactly the same between the participants with LCHAD and the control group. And if you go out towards this way in the orange, these are higher. And if you go out this way, they're lower. And the further away you go, the more different they are. And this line is the statistical significance. Everything above this is statistically different. I'll just point out a few. Again, the simple triglycerides, the relatively simple fatty acids hooked to a glycerol backbone are a little bit higher in blood. And the more complex, like phospholipids, sphingolipids, are a little bit lower in participants with LCHAD. Again, we had 189 lipids that were elevated, and those mostly triglycerides, and 186 that were lower, and it was mostly phospholipids, a little bit triglycerides, ceramides, some other complex lipids that were down. So not terribly surprising, but a little bit of more information about what's different in blood between participants who have LCHAD versus a control group. The last one I'll show you, and then I'll quit with my volcano plots, is things that are associated with fatty acids. So fatty acids don't circulate just loosely. They're usually bound to something. So we looked at that as well. And again, zero, they're exactly the same. The ones over here are higher. The ones over here are lower. So you can see there's not many that are higher. Most of them are, again, these simple triglycerides. There's a few compounds that are lower, ceramides, phospholipids, and the total fatty acids were lower. Now, I think some of this lower is related to the low-fat diet. I think that you eat a low-fat diet, you have lower fatty acids that are circulating in your blood, which just suggests that you're consuming less fat in your food. So I think some of this is related to the diet people are following as part of following a low-fat diet for LCHAD. So if you take all those volcano plots and those crazy description of those lipids, what do we know? Well, I think the thing it tells me is that 3-hydroxy fatty acids and 3-hydroxyacyl carnitines are definitely the biomarker. They are the thing that is most different, that are is most accumulated in blood of participants with LCHAD. So acyl carnitine profiles, which are a lot easier to measure than metabolomics, continues to be our best marker for these blood biomarkers in circulating in blood. So when you go to your metabolic physician and he orders an acyl carnitine profile, this really is the best biochemical test we can measure how much of these hydroxy fatty acids are circulating in your system. So let's just look at the acyl carnitines. We took those same samples and had them run for acyl carnitines. These, when you get your report back from your metabolic physician, these are the species that you might see on the report that are elevated. So you'll see a fatty acid that's got 14 carbons in one double bond. It's not too high. 14, 0 is no double bonds. 16, 1 is 16 carbon fatty acid with one double bond. 16, 0, no double bonds. 18 with two double bonds, that's linoleic acid. That's like in corn oil, safflower oil, most of the oils we cook with, this is the fatty acid that's there. 18.1, that's oleic acid. That's what we find in olive oil. And you can see that's the highest one. This one's the one that's most variable and the highest. And then here's the zero. Let me tell you a little bit about these box plots. So this box here is where 75% of the 40 people are, their level is somewhere in this box. And the line here is the average. The whiskers, these big long things, these, this is the highest one and this is the lowest one. So what you can see is that there's a lot of variability. So some people have pretty high 18.1 way up here closer to 2, and some people have almost 0 way down here. But most people are somewhere right here in the middle. So that's what these box plots show you, is this is what most people, this is after an overnight fast, what their hydroxyacyl carnitines look like if they have LCHAD. Somewhere in these areas here. So are these biomarkers, these things that are in blood of participants with LCHAD, are they associated with any sort of our either genotype or visual acuity that we've been measuring in our study? So let's look at genotype. So remember, TFP has no copy of that common mutation, and then here's one copy and here's two copies. And if we look at the acyl carnitine, sort of like a sum, this is a principal component. So it's kind of summing up the average of all those different ones. It's lowest in the patients with trifunctional protein. So they don't have that hydratase activity. So they have low hydroxyacyl carnitines. It's sort of intermediate, although it's really variable in people with one copy of the common mutation. And it's a little bit higher in people who have two copies of the common mutation. So acyl carnitines seem to be associated with genotype. There's a relationship between the amount of hydroxyacyl carnitines in your blood and your genotype. So what about vision, visual acuity? So we looked at the hydroxyacyl carnitines, that box plot, how much variability there was in an individual. And again, this log mar. So 0 is 20/20 vision and 2 is 20/632. So poor vision. And you can see there's this nice, there's a pretty good correlation. So one fasting blood sample and the higher hydroxyacyl carnitines are associated with lower vision. So decrease in vision with these high hydroxyacyl carnitines. So if that's true, if the 3-hydroxyacyl carnitines in your blood are associated, doesn't prove cause and effect, but associated with lower vision, how can you, as a person with LCHAD, lower those in your blood? So let's look at that. So this is a graph that we will, where we had people in the hospital in our clinical research center overnight. We woke up and we got a blood sample. So this is their fasting hydroxycholecarnitines. And then we fed them a standard breakfast. And then we measured blood 2 and 4 hours after breakfast. And then we fed them lunch. And then later in the afternoon, they walked on a treadmill and did some exercise. In the blue line, it's people with 2 copies of that common mutation. The orange line is 1 copy and 1 private mutation. And then the green line is the patients with trifunctional protein. So what you can appreciate is that after an overnight fast, after you fasted, the hydroxyacylcarnitines are up. So fasting is the best way to raise your hydroxyacylcarnitines, and eating is the best way to lower them. So eating a meal really substantially drops those hydroxyacylcarnitines. So the recommendation that we've always said about small, frequent meals and avoiding fasting, what that does is it really suppresses those hydroxyacylcarnitines. It lowers these things in your blood when you're eating small, frequent meals. Interestingly, exercise didn't do much to increase it. So I was a little surprised and pleased that if exercising doesn't seem to increase the hydroxyacylcarnitines too much. I don't know for sure. My hypothesis, what I think, is that most of these are coming from the liver and not from the muscle. So I'm not sure that exercise plays much of a role in these things in circulating. So the small frequent meals really lowers these hydroxyacylcarnitines. So I just analyzed this data yesterday. It's very preliminary. So this is the diet records from 26 of our 40 participants. So I still need to add the data from the other 14. But I just looked at percent of total calories. So if you look all the calories someone eats on those three-day diet records, how much of it comes from long chain fat? So how much is coming from that those foods that have long chain fat in it? So that's this graph over here. And we have the percent of calories from long chain fat in 2 to 7 year olds, 7 to 14, 15 to 21, and greater than 21. And again, this box plot shows where most everybody is. Here's the mean, and then the whiskers are the high and the low. What you can see is that it's increasing as you get older. It's hard to follow a low fat diet, and it gets harder as you get older. It's a little bit easier when your parents are picking all your foods and you're littler, but this is not an easy diet to follow. But most people are eating much less fat than the general U.S. population. So most people in the U.S. eat somewhere up here like 35-40%. Nobody's up there. Everyone's hovering around 10-20%. And I'd love to see that low-fat diet. So everybody's eating low-fat diet. It's just it's creeping up a little bit as people get older. It's a hard diet to follow. Interesting, the calories from MCT or C7 are kind of variable. There's some people that are eating a relatively high amount of MCT, like 20% of their calories, and some people that are eating zero almost in all categories. And so it seems pretty variable across all the different age groups. So does a low-fat diet lower your hydroxyacylcarnitine? So this is a dot plot. So we've got percents of long-chain fat from total calories on the x-axis, and then the acylcarnitine, that box, the range on the y. And there seems to be a pretty good correlation. So increasing your fat intake raises those hydroxyacylcarnitines, which are associated with lower vision. So following that low-fat diet seems to lower those hydroxyacylcarnitines. I didn't see, you know, we reported that before, but the MCT, I've seen in the past a negative correlation. I didn't see it so far. It seems sort of like just a dot plot everywhere. There doesn't seem to be a relationship. However, MCT does provide extra energy. So whether it specifically lowers the hydroxyacylcarnitines or it's just fueling your muscles and your heart, I don't know, but it does provide energy. So I don't want to suggest MCT is not beneficial. I think it is. I think it's really helpful. And I think, C7, but it doesn't seem, at least in this data, to lower those hydroxyacylcarnitines. We need to add more data and see if that's true, going forward, but at least in this analysis, it didn't look like there was a relationship. So looking at all that dietary and the metabolomics, what did we find out? Genotype, so what your genotype is, and diet really influence those 3-hydroxyacylcarnitine concentrations. High 3-hydroxyacylcarnitines are associated with lower visual acuity, and a low long chain fat diet is associated with lower 3-hydroxyacylcarnitines. The MCT, it doesn't look like it in this analysis, but I have seen that in the past, so I think this needs a little bit further research. So what do we do with this data? I think the biggest thing, drive home points, is eating regular small meals. So fasting really raises them. Eating is one of the best ways to lower those hydroxyacylcarnitines. Following a low fat, healthy, balanced diet does also lower them. And then following up with your metabolic physician routinely so you can see what those acylcarnitines are is a good idea just to check. I would suggest always getting, if you're going to get your blood drawn, do it at a consistent time. So eating and fasting, change them. So if you always go in first thing in the morning, get your blood drawn fasting, it'll be consistent over year to year to year when you go see your doctor. If you always get your blood drawn right after you eat breakfast, then do it the same time each time so you can consistently look at it from year to year as you go see your doctor. All right, so I'm going to switch gears completely and talk a little bit about our mouse model. I think last time I talked a little bit about our mouse. So we used a gene editing technique and we put the common mutation, the G1528C mutation, into a mouse. And I'm really excited. We got that first paper published. It's important that people see this mouse model in the literature and start recognizing the phenotype. So it's freely available. It's open access. You can download it from the internet if you're interested at all in reading it. So it was published in Communications Biology just a few months ago. So this is the data from the mouse paper. The mouse has a retinal phenotype. So the mice get retinopathy similar to what we see in human participants. So let me walk you through what we see in the mouse. So this is, I showed this last time. Spatial frequency is like testing a vision in a mouse. Now you can't make a mouse sit there and read a chart for you and tell you it's 20/20 vision or 20, that doesn't work. So the way we do this is the mouse sits on a platform and it would fall off. So it's sitting on this platform very delicately and there's a drum spinning around its head and you count the times it looks, it turns to look at something. So you know it saw something because it turned its head. And then we turn the drum the other way and it'll turn its head the other way so you know it saw something. So the way we measure vision as a mouse is we put them on this little platform and this drum goes around their head and we're watching how many times their heads turn. So the visual acuity, the ability to see, is lower in the LCHAT animal compared to the animal that does not have LCHAT. In this case, it's WT. And then we anesthetize them. The mice will also not sit still while you put in a contact lens on their eye and flash a light like patients do, human patients do. So we have to anesthetize them. We put them under and then we put the contact lens on and flash the light and they're on their eye. So this is the photopic wave. And you can see this nice, big, pretty response in the WT, the wild type animal, and the LCHAT, it's lower. So they have a lower photopic ERG response and then the lower scotopic. And this is the waves as well. So you see lower. So they have lower visual acuity, lower ERG, just like what we see in the human data. This is the fundal images. Now, the ophthalmologists tell me these are white spots. I have to say, I have a hard time seeing them. But they say those are white spots and the reviewer agreed with them. So I'm not going to argue, but it's really hard to tell, but they get the little white spots that we see similar in patients and they measured them. They counted the number of white spots and there's more in the eyes of the LCHAT eyes. And then this is looking at cross sections of the actual tissue. And we see these big white, circles. This is supposed to be a nice smooth layer here. And we see these white circles. We don't know what these white circles are, but they're disrupting the retinal pigment epithelium. We've tried to figure out what these white things are. We're still working on that, but there's this disruption that's happening in the RPE, and it's definitely more so in the L-chat animal. So that's what the phenotype looks like. So what was our next step? I think most of you knew that we were working on a retinal gene therapy treatment. So the next step, we were going to try to treat the mice and prevent the visual differences. So what we did is we created a copy of the gene. So this is the normal gene, and we put it inside a virus, and then we injected it in the back of the eye of the mouse when they were two months old, which is, that's a misspelling, sorry, mice, not mite. So they're 2 months old, and we injected them either with saline, so PBS is saline, or we injected them with the virus that had the vector in it. And then 8 months later, we checked their vision. And literally, I got this data this morning at about 10 o'clock. So we've just been doing this vision calculations this week, just this past couple of weeks. And so if you look at these animals are 10 months old. If you look at the saline, the L-CHAD mice have lower vision. So they don't turn their heads as much because they can't see as well. And then if you compare the ones that got the virus, their vision is not different than the wild type, and it's better than the saline treated. So this at least suggests, very small evidence, but suggests that the treatment might be working. It looks like maybe this retinal gene therapy helped the mice see better. We got a lot more studies to do. We haven't done the electroretinograms. We haven't done any other stuff. So we have a ton more work to do, but that's where we are right now with a treatment of the mouse using a retinal gene therapy approach to see if we can prevent the vision changes in the mouse. I'm going to stop there, but I want to again say this is a community effort. I cannot say thank you enough to everyone who has participated. It's a lot of work to fly to another place and go through all these testings, and it gives us so much good information. So I so appreciate it. We've had incredible support and funding from the community. We would not be in this position had it not been for all of your support. I have a whole team. I'm presenting data, but literally I know some of you have met many of these people. I couldn't do it by myself. I have a ton of people who have helped get all this together. So it really is a community effort, and I'm extremely grateful. So I'm going to stop there, and then I'm happy to answer any questions people might have.
All right. Thank you so much, Melanie. We really, really appreciate you taking the time. And there's lots of different segments that you presented. So there's lots going on. I think it's important to recognize all the data that you've collected. There's lots of different ways that it's going to be used in positive ways. And one of the things that you mentioned was the importance of being good advocates for the newborn screening. And I was curious if you could explain a little bit about that and maybe what other countries aren't currently screening for L-CHAD, and why it's important for us as parents and a variety of different countries to continue to advocate for that.
Well, let's start with the United States. I know for the most part, it's working really well. There have been one or two people who have been missed and who presented symptomatically because the screen cut off or the card didn't get back for whatever reasons. So I think we continue to support and advocate locally that we want our newborn screening programs to be adequately funded, adequately staffed, so that we can continue to screen babies well in the United States. And then for the most part, they do an excellent job. There's only one or two people that I know, and you know, since we've started screening, that have been missed. Internationally, both England and France in Europe do not screen for L-CHAD. They screen for VLCAD and MCAD, but they do not screen for L-CHAD. And their current reasoning is that they don't think it makes a difference long term. So I hope to advocate that that's not true, and that we need to, they can screen for L-CHAD. They should add that to their panels. Other countries who are just getting newborn screening up and going are probably starting with PKU or something like that. But as they add tests, I think encouraging them to consider fatty acid oxidation and LCHAD is a good idea.
So there's some questions that are popping in. And also just to let you guys know, you can feel free to raise your virtual hand and I can call on you if you want to ask your own questions or if I botch your question while I'm trying to ask it. One of the participants asked, when individuals fasted before the blood draw, what was the average fasting time? And did you look at that comparing, I think, the ACL carnitines?
So we asked everyone to fast 8 to 10 hours. And for some people, that was a little bit longer than what they were comfortable with. So the younger children, I don't think did that. I think it was more like 6, but they were all between 6 and 10 hours. That's unusual. And I wouldn't say do that all the time at home. But I think what we showed in that graph is that feeding and fasting changes it. And so to try to decrease the variability in our study, we wanted to draw the blood all at the same sort of time frame. So I think fasting, you don't want to do that on a regular basis for the blood draw to make sure that it's sort of consistent across time. I think it can be really helpful. So somewhere between 6 and 10 hours. The 6 hours was only in the really small 2, 3, 4 year olds.
Okay. Christy, I noticed that you turned your camera on, so maybe you're ready to ask your question, because she asked an important question, but I forget what it was in relation to and part of your topic. So I'm going to let her ask her question.
Okay. It was when we were talking about the cones and then like the black and white comparison and how it was trending down with LCHAD people. And I was just wondering if it normally trends down in people without LCHAD as they get older, or is it usually stay the same?
Usually stays the same. It can trend down later, but we're talking 60s, 70s, not 20s. So normally it stays pretty stable across the adult lifespan. Good question.
Someone else also asked, did you notice the difference between the vision of the males and the females?
That's a great question. That's come up a couple of times. And no, I don't see any gender differences. So I don't see a difference males and females. Now, I don't know. Oh, yes, we did. We included, my statistician included sex in the model to see if there was a difference, and it never came out significant. So there was not a statistically significant difference between males and females in that data set.
Okay. Okay, so you showed those volcano plots, which were pretty fun. I'm curious, like how you hope maybe dietitians could use this information in the future, and or if you think that dietitians running metabolomics like in the future could be a part of like the future care of LCHAD. And then I also saw taurine in there, and that was curious to me. So, because that is like a supplement that I know that some mito patients take. I'm just curious about your thoughts on any of that, what you can share.
Yeah. So I was really hoping metabolomics was going to really shed something really novel and exciting on that. The taurine might be an interesting observation. It is consistently low. I've seen that in other data sets. So that's of interest. But I have to say I'm in general somewhat disappointed, because really what it told me is what I already knew before I sent the blood samples to the lab. And that is that the acyl carnitines are really low, are really, really high. The ketones are low. There may be a few little things that are different, like the taurine, but I'm not seeing other things that are popping out going, wow, that's a really great biomarker. So far it's really just sent me back to the acyl carnitine profile is our best biomarker at the moment.
In regards to the metabolomics, another patient asked if you compare the blood levels of abnormal metabolites between patients that had better vision and those who had worse vision.
Or that's a great, you could yeah, that's future. A great question. And we are going to try to address that. I need to have a good conversation with our statistician about how to do that. It's a ton of numbers. And so it's a little bit hard for me to envision how we do it statistically. So we have not done that yet, but yes, maybe when we do that analysis, something will pop out. That's a helpful biomarker, but, so far, we haven't done that yet.
Amy Calvert has her hand up, so I'll let her go.
Hi, everyone. So my son, Landon, he's 4, and his geneticist has said that he has a mild case of LCHAD. I keep forgetting kind of like how that correlates and like on the spectrum of things. Like, I know there's severity and, you know, some are more severe than others. So with the panel that were in this study, how many had a mild case of LCHAD and these conditions versus like a more severe case? I just don't know. The severity like playing a part in this?
Yes, exactly how it's hard to put a finger on. So I'll tell you what I think is going on, and I will give this caveat that it's not exactly well-defined. So I think when we're calling it mild LCHAD, it's that one copy of the common mutation and a mild, a single change on that other allele that doesn't affect the protein that much. That's what I think is happening. So I would call that one copy of the common mutation, one copy. That's what I think is what we're calling mild. And if you looked at our, when I did the graphs, that the purple that was one copy, there was a lot of variability. So some people had better vision and some people had worse vision within that group. There was a lot of variability in that group. So I think that is represented by a mild or severe, depending on that second mutation. But that's never been defined. So I don't have a nomenclature. I don't have a table I can go to and say, this person is mild, this person is severe. I think we're still defining that now. I think before we did newborn screening, we didn't think there was any mild LCHAD. It's not until we've started picking up other milder cases with newborn screening that we even realize that there is the spectrum. I think we all thought it was always the severe form that we're familiar with. So I think that that's a slowly evolving aspect of this disease that we are just now starting to understand. In the next several years, maybe we'll come up with a classification that'll say this is mild or severe, that second mutation. But right now, we have not done that.
That's really helpful, Melanie. Thank you for explaining all of that. Another patient asked, is anyone researching ways to tie up the ACL carnitines in the blood? For example, I know there's been talk of an acetylcysteine being helpful.
That is an excellent, excellent question. So like a chelator or something that would bind it up and lower it out of blood. I don't know that anyone's tried anything, but yes, we've talked about it. In MCAD, there was a study where we tried glycine to see if it would bind up some of those things and get excreted in the urine. It's never been tried in LCHAD that I know of, where you just, you know, take some extra glycine to see if that would work. I don't know. They're not very water soluble, so I don't know if they'll come out in the urine. That's a wonderful idea. I had someone I recently presented in the Netherlands, and they were asking, well, what if you blocked the hydratase? What if you stopped the making of the hydroxyacyl carnitines? That's another idea. So there's a lot of ideas we could try to see if we could lower them. But to my knowledge, we haven't yet, but those are great ideas. And yeah, it's certainly something we could look at. So something that would bind them up like a chelator and get them out of blood, or something that would lower their production by, say, inhibiting the hydratase, or I don't know. There's lots of different ways we could try to think about lowering them.
Somebody else asked, were you able to locate where the eye deterioration begins?
It definitely starts in the middle. And the way Dr. Panisi and some of the ophthalmologists describe it to me is sort of little holes. They get poked in the center, and then they sort of spread is the way they describe it. And I think the pictures kind of look like that too. You'll start with the visual fields where they're just little holes, and then it starts getting a little bit bigger. So it is sort of central and kind of grows out towards the periphery or the side of the eye.
And then you commented that the contrast sensitivity affects being able to distinguish between white and gray, as well as distinguishing between shades. Is that related to the color saturation issues in the eyes, or is that different?
I don't know if that test is related. I think it's a test where like there's a black and white checkerboard and it becomes grayer and grayer and smaller until all you see is gray. I think that's what the test is that we're talking about. So I don't know that it has much to do with color saturation, but I would have to ask an ophthalmologist to be sure.
These are a lot of great questions that are filtering. And so I appreciate you taking the time and answering them, and also just throwing out ideas and stuff like that too. I mean, it's really helpful. This is part of why we're all here, is because we're all curious, and we appreciate your feedback and your willingness to be honest with us. And we were talking about that earlier a little bit. Science is unpredictable, right? Yeah. And sometimes it can be disheartening when you don't have all the answers. But it's amazing to watch you continue to pursue and pursue and pursue. And we really do appreciate that. I hope you have time for a couple more questions, because they're still filtering in.
Yes.
Another patient asked, is there a supplement that you would generally recommend for LCHAD patients to help support good eye health, such as DHA, lutein, et cetera? I know there's been some publications about that. Where do you stand with that
right now? So I'd love to say that yes, I mean, there's a supplement, but to be honest, we just don't know. So there are supplements that I was on a panel and we looked at the supplements for age-related macular degeneration, which is a completely different disease. And it had lutein and zeaxanthin, and that seemed to be beneficial in those patients. Does it help with LCHAD? We just don't know. DHA, we did see low DHA, and I think low DHA is probably not good. So supplementing DHA to keep it in the normal range is probably a good idea. I don't know that it needs to be super physiologic, like really high doses. Would vitamin A or vitamin E or one of those other vitamins that are associated with eye health help? I think those are all questions we need to answer, but it's really hard to test. I'm going to try to dig really deep in the among the 40 participants we have and see if there's differences in people who take supplements who don't. But the numbers are really small, and so it's going to be really hard to even though 40 sounds like a huge number in the LCHAD world, it's still hard to compare people who take an eye supplement versus don't, and is there a difference in vision? So they're great questions. I'd say keep DHA in the normal range. The other ones, we just don't know. Is it possible that they help? Yeah, it's certainly possible. We just haven't studied it, so I don't know for sure.
And that's helpful. That was going to be my next question to ask, is if with the study, if you were going to look at the supplements that people are on, but it sounds like even within that 40, there's probably a lower percentage that are on the supplements. So that makes it hard to compare as well. But
we
maybe
will,
something
though.
To
we
do
will.
A case study on if it's remarkable, like.
Right. We have a supplemental questionnaire with all the supplements. So I'll break it out and look at those that are taking, the ARAD supplement or taurine or whatever, and see if I see anything. But again, those numbers are going to be pretty small, and there's all the other factors you need to consider, like genotype, diagnosis, timing, those kinds of things, which we know have an impact. So it's possible that we could tell something, but I don't want to set everyone up to be disappointed, because it's going to be challenging.
Did you see a bigger increase in visual deterioration during puberty? Was that data that was able to be extracted?
Okay, so just to be really clear about the data. So right now we're repeating all the measures in everyone after 2 years. And so at that point, we'll calculate rate of change. But the data I'm showing right now is cross-sectional. So it's 40 different individuals. So I can't say that there's an increased rate of change in puberty until we get that data that we're collecting now. So that 2-year data is really important to say how much did it change over 2 years. That's never been done. We've never had a study that's looked at how fast it changes over time, prospectively, forward in time. So this will be the first data that'll look at rate of change. And we should have that data everybody will be seen for their 2-year visit in like late spring of 2024. And then we'll start having the statistician look at rate of change. How much did it change? And is it different in 2 to 7 year olds versus, you know, 8 to 15 versus older? Is it different by genotype? We'll look at all that, but we have to get that data. And then we're in the process of collecting it right now.
Amazing. Amazing. So here's a tricky question, but one that I know is on lots of people's minds. Stress, like, can stress, we know that stress can induce metabolic episodes, but how does that elevate or raise ACL carnitines? Do we know that, or how would we test for
we've
that?
Never done a formal study, but I can give you my thoughts just knowing biology. So stress hormones, whether it's cortisol or whatever, what that does is it causes release of free fatty acids from adipose tissue. So it basically is telling your body, okay, we need more energy. So you're releasing some of those fatty acids from adipose tissue. They go to the liver tries to convert them to energy, and it makes hydroxyacyl carnitine. So my guess is stress will raise them because of the cortisol, the hormonal effect of releasing free fatty acids from your adipose tissue. Has it ever been measured or tested? No, but that would be my a priori thought, that that's what would happen in a really high stress condition. But it's, we haven't actually measured it. I'm just guessing based on what I know about stress and cortisol and its impact on metabolism.
And that's so hard because, right, we all go through periods of stressed times.
I know.
And to tell a patient, just don't stress out. That's going to be
exactly. That's not going to work. That doesn't work, right?
Oh, my. Yeah. So there have been a couple questions that have come through the chat, and I don't want to like force you to give a whole other presentation on ketones, but right, like everybody after the conference this summer is like, ketones. And so I'm curious, like in hypothesis mode, like if you think that that also could be an impactful treatment on the ACL carnitines, and if you want to slide any information in there about where ketones are at or those studies are going or anything like that while we have LCHAD families and patients on the
call. Sure. So our ketone data, it did show that it suppressed the acyl carnitine. So that was a surprise to me when we did the study, but that was its biggest effect. So normally ketones are really low because you can't oxidize fat in the liver. And when we gave oral ketones, it suppressed those acyl carnitines, they were lower. So do I think it could potentially lower hydroxyacyl carnitines? Absolutely, I do. Now, ketones are short-lived. So they're kind of like, what can I make an analogy of? They're kind of like goo that you would do in a marathon. Like, well, they go up and they come down. So we're not talking long-term. So to consistently suppress them, you would have to do smaller frequent doses, like every 4 hours or something like that, if you really wanted to use ketones to suppress hydroxyacyl carnitines. Is it possible? Yeah. And I was surprised at how efficient they were at suppressing acyl carnitines in our study. So yes, I think that ketones could do that. Where are the products now and where are they going? That I think is still up in the air. I need to get in touch with Nestle again from our study. They're interested in doing more studies, but they seem to be a little bit slow on whatever they're considering right now. They talked about doing a dose. I do think the doses that we tried was really low. And so I think it's worthy looking at a better dose. What's the right dose of ketones? I'd love to make sure that they taste as good as they could. I know they're not tasty, but I think, you know, a lot of them are pretty salty, gross. So I'd hope that they improve the flavor. Are they coming? Yes, down the pike. In the next 6 months? No. Next 2 or 3 years, potentially.
And the ketones that you tested, remind me, they were the salt ketones, right? So like you wouldn't want to just guesstimate and then you have a salt overload issue, right?
That's always been the issue with the salt ketones, is the salt overload. There are esters where it's bound to a glycerol backbone and you can buy them. Athletes are using them right now. The esters taste even worse. I've had some people tell me that they vomit after they've taken them. Well, that nobody wants to do that. So I don't know. The esters there's been one study in VLCAD and it raised the the ketones really high, but whether it's a doable treatment to lower acylcarnitines in the long term, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I think that wraps it up. I'm going to double one check and make sure. Okay. Let me throw two more questions at you, Dr. Gillingham. I promise. Then we're going to be done after that.
Okay.
One was asking, since 3-hydroxyacylcarnitines are elevated after fasting, do you recommend a midnight snack? And if so, is there a good range of calories or MCT/triheptanoin?
That's a great question, and one that, you know, I don't know. I'm a little on the fence on this. So I do think that, you know, normal feeding and fasting for the liver is a good idea. And we've in general not done like overnight tube feedings in our really little ones. But does that lower the acylcarnitines? Yes. So I'm a little bit on the fence. So you need a midnight snack. You do not need a midnight snack to keep your glucose up. So the glucose for someone with LCHAD should stay normal for a whole night sleeping. But those acylcarnitines do creep up after 8 to 10 hours, and then eating in the morning is important to lower them. So would a midnight snack lower those? Yes. If you were going to do that, I would do small. So again, I'm a little bit on the fence. I would do, you know, a couple hundred calories at the most for an adult, just to suppress lipolysis. But I don't know. I'm a little on the fence on whether that's good long-term or if that would not be long-term good for your liver. I don't know.
And snack versus cornstarch or?
Oh, I would definitely do snack versus, so cornstarch is just empty calories. And again, the reason for using cornstarch is to keep the glucose up. That's not the issue here. We're trying to suppress lipolysis, the release of free fatty acids from adipose tissue. So you don't need cornstarch to keep the glucose up. You just need some calories that are going to suppress the lipolysis. So I wouldn't do cornstarch. Besides, who likes to drink balls of cornstarch? Yeah.
All right.
Looks Claire, like Claire's. Claire's
I know. I got to call him Claire, right?
I'm so sorry. I couldn't hold back on that question. I think from like a biochemical standpoint, and you guys can correct me, but if you have a lipostart or a portogen or something kind of glycemic-y prior to your child's bedtime routine or your bedtime routine, you should be metabolizing that while you're sleeping for a period of time.
Yes.
And you should be okay at that point. You're going to be probably truly fasting between 4 and 6 hours before your next meal. So you should be okay unless they're in a metabolic crisis, like breaking down of your muscles or something. But if patients or parents ever want to talk to someone who's been through it, I'm happy to answer it from an adult perspective. But I think metabolically speaking, you should be okay. But Melanie, thank you so much. I know this has been like 10 plus years of hard work for you and your team. And what exciting new stuff you're learning every 6 months, something new. So thank you.
Thank you, Claire. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Melanie. And I also have to think about too, like the hours, right? Like how many hours a teenager might sleep might be very different than like, you know, a young adult, or, you know, I don't know, people sleep for different lengths of time. So, but all of these amazing questions that everybody has presented, I just appreciate everyone for coming out tonight, for bringing your questions, for, taking time to listen to the amazing information that Melanie has. And there's lots of thank yous going on in the chat right now to you, Melanie, and your team. We really, really appreciate all the hard work that you do. I just echo everything that Claire said. We really, really appreciate you. So thank you so much for coming out tonight and sharing all of this with us.
Yes, happy to. It's good to see everybody's faces.
All right. Well, if anybody wants to relook at this webinar, everything has been recorded and it'll be posted here in the next week or so. And so you can come back because there's a lot of information to digest at one time. And feel free to also send it off to a family member or friend, maybe that wasn't able to attend the meeting. And until next time, bye.